Welcome everyone. Says 12. So this is the 12th meeting of this series. The baby's 11 years old now. It's a pleasure to see this still being lively. And this is the second meeting in Budapest, second in this beautiful building, in fact. You can't imagine how difficult it was this year to set it up. And I think that until a few weeks ago, we weren't sure whether we'd be able to do it on site. So it's great that many people came, and we hope that there'll be more coming for next sessions. And the work that István did for this is really outstanding. So thank you very much, István. Another person who did a tremendous job here is Maciek Maliborski, who I don't want to count the number of emails that flowed. So given that, it's a great pleasure to see Zoe with us today. She already spoke at these meetings, but as a participant, not now as a keynote invited lecturer. It's great to see how impressive are the things you're doing now. And so Zoe from Cambridge now it will tell us about how to stabilize relativistic fluids. So, Zoe.
Thank you, Fiat. Thank you very much. I'll just put that there. Okay. All right, so good morning, everyone. Thank you all for being here. Thank you very much to the organisers for the kind invitation. I have been coming to these Central European Relativity Seminars since I was a PhD student, and they're like my favourite event of the year. I really encourage younger participants here to come to these events. You get to meet fellow relativists and, you know, have great conversations and practice presentations. So I think it's a really good concept. So today I'm going to tell you about stabilizing relativistic fluids on slowly expanding cosmological spacetimes. And the kind of the big goal is looking at the stability of cosmological spacetimes that we fill with idealized perfect fluids. Okay, and so let's say this picture here is kind of broadly looking at the evolution of our universe going from inflation. And in different epochs of our universe, we believe we have different types of fluids, we have different interactions between fluids. I'm coming from a more mathematical perspective, looking at stability, but kind of this is the broader goal, per se, is trying to understand different models that we use to describe different parts of this picture. Two results that I will tell you about today are listed here. The first one is with David Feynman from Vienna and Todd Olenek from Monash. That's a paper that's now in CMP. And a later preprint, which isn't in a journal yet, but is on archive, is with David Feynman and Max Offner, who's here from Vienna. So I'll hopefully just tell you a little bit about these as we go along. But I did take this a bit as a lecture, so there'll be a lot of introduction, and I hope it doesn't bore too many of you, and maybe you'll learn something along the way. So I'm interested in cosmological solutions to the Einstein equations, which essentially means here that I've allowed for a cosmological constant. And we start from the cosmological principle, which says that our universe is spanned by some fundamental observers, okay? And their timelines span their space-time, and they experience something called cosmic time. Okay, their proper time is cosmic time, which I'm going to denote TC. And we suppose that these fundamental observers, at large scale, see certain things in the distribution of matter. Okay, so, for example, they see, or one supposes, that one of these observers sees the same distribution of matter regardless of the direction that they look, okay, which is what we refer to as isotropic, and also regardless of their location. Okay, and this is what we refer to as homogeneous. Now, I've just got a little picture here to show you how these two concepts can be different. So it's possible to have something which is homogeneous but not isotropic, and isotropic but not homogeneous. And also here's another example here, homogeneous but not isotropic. An isotropic but not homogeneous. Okay, so now where do we get this idea of isotropy, let's say? Where does this come from? This comes from, of course, the CMB. Sorry, here I've put WMAP. This is the earlier experiment, but the later observations come from Planck. And so this is a remnant of our early universe, where we see the radiation that very closely matches the spectrum of black body radiation. Okay, and so this radiation is uniform to roughly one part in 100,000, which is very small. Okay, and so in particular, we see a lot of isotropy. Okay, now we see this at our point on planet Earth, but we don't suppose that we live in a special position in our universe. Okay, so in particular, we are led to expect isotropy about every point. Okay, so this is our observational starting point, but of course, you do make a lot of assumptions along the way, okay? And to build a cosmological model, you do have to make simplifications. And so this very much is going, you will see these arising. Okay, so this is, let's say, one such simplification. Thanks to these cosmological principles, your space-time metric takes the following split. So here we have, let's say, an interval times a three-manifold with the following metric. So I've got this cosmic time, TC, there. And H now is a Riemannian metric on M, okay, and it can depend on time. And we require this Riemannian space to be isotropic. Okay. And so what does this do? Well, this gives you some restrictions on your notion of curvature. Okay, so if we look at isotropy at a point, well, this implies that the sectional curvature that you take is independent of the choice of plane, okay, about that point. And another way to see this is, in fact, then the Riemann tensor takes a specific form. So here the Riemann tensor takes the form here in equation 3, so I have a constant kappa, which could in principle depend on x, okay, but I have a particular form of the metric. And you note here I've put a g, but that should already be an h. Sorry about that. Okay, so the Riemann tensor takes a particular form under this assumption of isotropy. Now, if we go even further, we can say, well, let's suppose that this Riemannian 3-manifold is isotropic at every point. Well, that tells us that this kappa is a constant. Okay, let's say kappa 0, whatever you might want to call it. And you can then show that, in fact, this means that your 3-manifold is locally isometric to one of three possible spaces. Okay, so here we have hyperbolic 3-space, R3, and the 3-sphere. Okay, so it's a very restricted set. You know, having made this assumption, we have a very smaller set already of possible spaces. Now, you can also characterize the metric. So here I've chosen spherical coordinates just because I thought it looked a bit nicer, but you can choose lots of different types of coordinates. And this is, let's say, what our metric now looks like. So we pick up the metric on our 3-manifold, okay, and you note there that it depends on the parameter kappa, which you can rescale to just depend on its sign. Okay, so in particular, we can rescale it, so it's either plus 1, 0, or minus 1. And you'll note in equation 5 now, we pick up this arbitrary function A of t. Okay, so it's an arbitrary function of time. So this is the form of our metric now. And we see that our 3-manifold, can look in different cases. So it could look a bit like a flat universe. We could have some negative curvature here. Okay, so your angles are measured. Your angles measure differently, and then we can also here have a closed, more like a closed surface. Looks like part of a sphere. Okay, so these are homogeneous spaces, because at the start I said that we need to suppose isotropy and homogeneity. And in fact, if you assume isotropy at every point, you can show that this implies local homogeneity. So there's a little bit of subtlety here about what kind of homogeneity you allow, and I just want to kind of tell you that it's also possible to allow quotient spaces. Okay, so we don't just need to allow for H3, R3, and S3, we can also allow for quotients thereof. Okay, so H3 quotienting out a certain subgroup of the isometry group, and obviously T3 is R3 quotienting out identification points. Okay, so you can also allow these kinds of topologies and these kinds of 3-manifolds. So in summary now, we have this form of the metric, okay, so we have this factor A of t appearing in front of our 3-manifold, and we call this the scale factor precisely because it measures the spatial distance as it scales between fundamental observers. Okay, so I guess here I'm really thinking about the case of an expanding universe, okay, so if A dot is positive, and so in particular this scale factor, if you have two fundamental observers and you measure the distance between them at a later time, that distance will will scale with this factor A of TC. And we're fairly sure we live in an expanding universe, okay? So that's something else to know. And just so you know the terminology, we often call these coordinates up here, we call them co-moving coordinates. And if an observer has a velocity u, which with respect to these coordinates takes this form 1, 0, 0, 0, then we call it a co-moving observer. Okay, but that's just some terminology that I probably won't use later on, but I just thought I'd put these things in. Okay, so this is the scale factor, which is going to play a very important role in my talk. So now I've told you a lot about the geometry, okay, but I haven't told you about the matter. I haven't told you about the right-hand side of the Einstein equations. So this is the next part. So we can suppose that we have an observer moving along some trajectory with time length for velocity u, okay? And we can actually decompose the stress-energy tensor with respect to this observer, okay? So we can look at the components of this stress-energy tensor as the observer would measure. So this this equation 8 here is what we see, okay? And so we pick up different components. Roughly speaking, your splitting into components that are kind of orthogonal, g-orthogonal with respect to this observer, or g-perpendicular with respect to this observer, but there's also some further decomposing that happens. Okay, so you can write this out, and now we can identify pieces of this decomposition as things that we would experimentally measure. Okay, so for example, the observer will measure an energy density, rho, and rho here is given by this expression. Okay, it may measure a pressure or an energy flux. Okay, and so now we take the 10 components of this stress-energy tensor, the unknown components, and we can kind of repackage them into these other unknown components, so things like the energy density rho, the pressure p, and other components. Now, the symmetry of our model, okay, of the FLRW model, forces the stress-energy tensor to take the algebraic form of a perfect fluid. Okay, so if you haven't met a perfect fluid before, this is literally what you define it to be. This is its algebraic form. And so that is already a restriction on the kind of matter models that you can allow if you take this level of symmetry. So here we just have a perfect fluid. Its particles move along with full velocity u, and we have an energy density rho and a pressure p. In this symmetry, they're only functions of cosmic time. Okay, but you know this is obviously coming from the symmetry in this setting. I think that's... and I should also just mention that we've normalized this full velocity here, so it's time-like. So we've normalized this inner product here with respect to the G metric to be minus 1. Okay, so this is the symmetry of the FLRW model. So now you look to see... Well, now we've just put everything together. Okay, so we can take the Einstein equations and the left-hand side of these equations is covariantly constant, which of course implies the equations of motion for our matter field, so that's what the second line here is. So this is the equation of motion for the fluid. And so this highly nonlinear system of partial differential equations simplifies quite a lot. Okay, so in particular, there's only one non-trivial equation coming from the equation for the stress-energy tensor, and this reduces to what's called the continuity equation, okay, conservation of energy. This is equation 11 here. So here we have rho dot is related to rho, the pressure, and also a factor of the, and also the scale factor. And this combination here, A dot over A, you'll often see in cosmology textbooks written as a Hubble parameter. Okay, so this is the equation 11 is obviously the matter, what happens to the matter. And then we also have two equations coming from the geometry, coming from the Einstein equations. Well, it's not obvious that there's two, but there are two. Okay, and the first of these is sometimes called the Raichaduri equation, that's given in equation 12. And we also have the Friedman equation here, equation 13. Okay, so the dot here is only denoting differentiation with respect to cosmic time. And you'll note that we're picking up different components here. So here we have both parts of the fluid, the energy density and the pressure, and we also can have an effect coming from the cosmological constant. Down here we can have the energy density and lambda and kappa. Okay, so all these different components now arise in these equations. But obviously the best things about equations 11 to 13 is that they're a coupled system of ODEs, okay, which is obviously a lot easier to solve than the nonlinear partial differential equations that the equation 10 is. Okay. Now, we actually didn't have enough equations then to close the system. Okay, so maybe you need to think about that. So what we also need to do is we also need to include what's called an equation of state. Okay, so this is a thermodynamic relationship between your different variables in the fluid. So you can also include at this point a relationship, let's say, between the pressure and the energy density. But you could be more general, okay? You could also include a relationship between the particle number density and the entropy per particle. It can get quite complicated. It is quite common in cosmology, actually, in our standard model of our Big Bang universe, to use a linear barotropic equation of state. So here you see that we've actually set the particle number density to be constant. The entropy is also constant here, actually. So we only have a relationship between the pressure, P, and the energy density, rho. That's what it means to be barotropic. And it's linear, okay? So P is equal to K times rho. And the only restriction I've put here on K is that it's less than or equal to 1, okay? Which comes from, well, I'll say where it comes from in just a sec. So now there are important cases within this model, okay, within this equation of state. The simplest one is where we take K to be zero, okay, and so this means you have pressureless matter, which is what we call dust. Okay, so this is, let's say, would model kind of a fluid of particles where their rest mass energy is the dominant piece of their energy momentum. And here I've written also that there you can think of this as kind of neighboring fluid elements exert no action on each other. Okay, there is no pressure. Another important case is that of K equals 1/3, which is called a radiation fluid. And so this describes a gas of particles which are highly energetic. Okay, the kinetic energy is dominating the energy. And this number 1/3, it might look quite strange, right? If you've done a course in cosmology, you will have derived this number. Okay, it comes from some thermodynamic laws, but kind of a priori, if you see it here, it seems very odd to just have a number 1/3, okay? But it does come out in the wash. Another case of K equals 1 is called a stiff fluid, okay, which is a different kind of fluid that you can consider. Now, you may also see in textbooks, you may see K written as the speed of sound. So this is actually a definition here of what the speed of sound is, okay? It's the rate of change of the pressure with respect to the energy density keeping entropy constant. Okay, and so this is the reason why we have the restriction to K being less than or equal to 1, because 1 here is the speed of light. Okay, so I'm saying that the speed of fluid needs to be less than the speed of light, which is what you would expect on relativistic grounds. Now, there's a whole plethora of equations of state. Okay, and this is, I would think, the simplest one that you can have. But let me just mention also another well-known one called the polytropic equations of state. So here the pressure is equal to a constant times rho to the gamma, where gamma is typically taken to be bigger than 1. Okay, and this is something that you might use to model, or is used to model a star. Okay, so a fluid here with a boundary. All right, so this is the equation of state that I need to close my system of equations. And so using this assumption, we can make some immediate observations. So this is not so relevant to the talk today, but I just thought it's nice to see. So if you take the contraction of the Ricci tensor, you get this following expression here. Okay, so you may have a cosmological constant, and you get 1 minus 3k times rho. So in particular, if your fluid develops a shock, let's say, in some sense, if rho goes to infinity, well, then you see that will affect your curvature. Okay, so you can just see it already there at the level of the equation. I'm talking about stabilizing fluids today, though, so my energy density will not be going to infinity. Another very simple thing that you can do now is you can integrate up the continuity equation. Okay, you can replace the pressure and the continuity equation by, you know, a factor times the energy density, and you get the following expression needs to be constant. So you get rho times the scale factor to some power now needs to be a constant. And this obviously matches the intuition that you might have that as your scale factor grows, okay, as this universe is expanding, your energy density is diluting. Okay, you're not creating energy from nothing. And you note, though, that the rate at which this dilution happens depends on the type of fluid that you have at hand. Okay, it depends on K. So that's one immediate consequence, okay, of taking this equation of state. Something else you can do now is to substitute this constant, so this line that I've got up here. You can substitute this into the Friedmann equation, and you get the equation 16 here. Okay, so now you can really see all the different, let's say, contributions, because we've taken out a lot of the fluid terms, we've taken out rho and p, so you can really kind of look at this equation and study it. And you can do some heuristic arguments here. So just as an example, if kappa is negative, okay, then minus kappa is positive, and on the left-hand side we've got a dot, okay, so we see that a needs to grow at least linearly. Okay, so you can do kind of very ad hoc, back of the envelope kind of estimates on how the scale factor grows, or how it grew in the past, let's say, if you go backwards in time. So I'm now going to give you four special solutions to these equations. Okay, so so using all these tools that we've built up. So the first one is a very special, very special solution. Called the Einstein static universe, given here in equation 17. So here I've taken kappa to be plus 1, so this is on S3. Okay, I'm not taking a cosmological constant at this point. And so it's a static universe because this scale factor here, A of naught, is a constant. Okay, it does not depend on cosmic time, TC. Okay, it's a constant here. And for this to be a solution, you need to take the following fluid variable. So you need to take rho to be 3 over this constant squared, and you need to take the pressure to be negative, okay, minus this constant. Okay, so in this case here, K is equal to minus 1/3. And so Einstein obviously arrived at this solution and was very unhappy at this pressure being negative. Okay, this is something on physical grounds that he was not happy with, and so one way that you can remedy this is by including a cosmological constant, okay, in your equations. But I'm not going to write those details down, but at least there you see how this solution fits into this kind of broader FLRW framework. Another very important solution is called the flat FL, matter-dominated universe. I was taught FLRW in my cosmology course, and I always call them FLRW, but somehow subsets of those letters are used in different scenarios. Okay, so here we have equation 18. So I've just put this on R3. Or T3, let's say, so kappa is equal to 0 here. There is no cosmological constant. And we see here a scale factor grows like this, and we have a certain energy density, which, unsurprisingly, is decreasing with T. And obviously T, there should be TC, cosmic time. Okay, so it's diluting as time goes forward. And now this is an example of what I call a decelerating space-time, okay? The expansion is decelerating, and that's because A dot is positive here, but A double dot is negative, okay? And the particular case of dust here when K is equal to 0 is called the Einstein de Sitter universe. So I think this was actually probably the first one that was written down, and then we've got this more general case written here in equation 18. And so this is one of the most frequently used models by cosmologists, okay? This is a special solution, unlike equation 17, that is actually used. So the next special solution is one I'm sure you're all very aware of, is the de Sitter universe. So here I've put it on R3 again, and I've decided to take the cosmological constant to be positive. Okay, you can achieve this with exotic fluids, but let's just do it this way. Okay, and we see now that the scale factor A of T grows exponentially. Okay, e to the square root of lambda, maybe some numbers are missing there, but it grows exponentially is the point. And so this is an example of accelerated expansion, okay, because A dot is positive, but A double dot is also positive, okay, it's growing at an accelerated rate. And so experiments suggest that we're currently in an epoch in our universe that probably will never end, okay, of accelerated expansion. So this is obviously a widely used model of our later universe. And the last solution I want to give you is very relevant to the talk today, and it's called, or here it's called, the open Milne vacuum universe. Okay, so the Milne universe. So we take kappa here to be negative, right? So kappa is minus one, lambda is zero. Okay, and the metric is the following here. So we have the appropriate hyperbolic metric here, but the scale factor grows linearly. A of t is equal to t, and I'm sorry that t here is not tc. Okay, so this is an example of zero accelerated expansion, because a dot is positive, but a double dot is equal to zero. Okay, it's a critical case. I call it the open universe here because I haven't taken out a quotient. At this point, you could think of this as just on all of hyperbolic space. And it is a vacuum universe, okay? We don't have any matter in this space, in this special solution. Okay, so four different types of solutions. And the way I've set things up, I hope you see that the scale factor is the thing that I'm really interested in and is really going to affect properties of the fluid. Okay, so this is, let's say, just a picture that summarizes some of the models that I've just told you about. Okay, so you can see here, okay, they're not all represented on the picture, but I hope at least you get the idea that there's a lot of models out there, okay, a lot of cosmological models that we can use, and quite a few of them do match the data. Okay, so we have, let's say on the left here, we've got possibly a decelerating universe, something that eventually collapses into a big crunch. We can have something which is slowly decelerating, okay, so this would be the flat FL universe, okay, the Einstein de Sitter. We can have an empty, freely expanding universe. This is like the Milne that I spoke about. And then, let's say, we can try and patch these together to get the best model that we can for our universe. And now I found this picture yesterday on Google. I can't really ascertain to how correct it is, but I thought at least it illustrated the point that we think we're currently in a period of acceleration. And we're fairly sure that in the past we were in a period of deceleration, okay, in our early universe. And so at some point we had to transition. Okay, and it turns out that a lot of the mathematical results, like kind of very abstract mathematical results that we know, have very much focused on this later period, this acceleration period. And so what I'm now interested in is looking earlier than that, going to regions of deceleration or possibly the critical in-between point of linear expansion. So this is now what I do in my research, okay, and this is what I want to tell you about. So I now want to move outside of symmetry, and I want to understand if any of these models are realistic models for our universe. And one approach you can have to this is to say, well, they should be stable under small initial data perturbations of the Einstein equations. Okay, so here I have the Einstein relativistic Euler equations. So in equation 21, so I've written them out in full glory here. So we have an equation for the geometry and obviously for the energy density and the four velocity. Okay, and so I think now of studying some initial data set up for this problem. So here I have a Riemannian metric and a second fundamental form. I'd obviously also need initial data for the fluid. Okay, and I need to evolve this forward and see what happens. Obviously, this is a subtle question because you think of evolving forward in time, but we know that in relativity, what is your notion of time? Okay, now in cosmology, we have a preferred notion of cosmic time, so somehow you can do a little away with a little bit of that. But we're essentially just wanting to understand what is the long-time behavior, okay? What is the asymptotic behavior? So if you consider this previous slide here as some initial data, okay, that produces the special solution that we're interested in, okay? And you now say, okay, well, I'm going to slightly perturb that initial data, okay, with respect to some Sobolev space, most likely, okay? And then different scenarios can happen, okay? We can asymptote back, this bottom one here, is to the state that we started from. We can asymptote back to that special solution. The middle case here could be, well, maybe we asymptote to another solution, okay? Perhaps that matter disperses in some sense, and so we get a different solution. And the top case is supposed to represent if perhaps something goes wrong, a singularity forms, a black hole forms, something like that. Obviously, you know, this is not just a topic that's studied in cosmology. One, you know, very important line of research is looking at what happens when you consider a small perturbation of a black hole. Okay, and you think you've got some black hole which is rotating. If you give it a certain amount of energy, does it asymptote to the same black hole, a slightly different black hole? You know, what kind of understanding that process is a very important line of research in the initial value formulation of the Einstein equations. Okay, so this is let's say the mathematical goal that we're looking at is to try and understand, you know, which of these scenarios are we in, and using this as some kind of way to determine if a space-time is a reasonable model for our universe. Now, obviously, the Einstein static universe is an unstable solution. Okay, this is something that Einstein himself realized. Okay, so already we can exclude that, let's say, on instability grounds. Okay. So now studying the full Einstein relativistic Euler equations is a bit tough. Okay, they're quite complicated equations. They're nonlinear, quasi-linear PDEs. So you can do some simpler problems. The first of these is to, let's say, just fix the geometry, to cut out the Einstein equation. So you fix G just to be a Lorentzian metric. Okay, it doesn't even need to be a space-time. Yeah, it can just be some Lorentzian metric, and you just study the relativistic Euler equations on this space. Okay, so that's one simpler problem, which is still very tough, I should say. Okay, it doesn't take everything out. Another simpler problem that you can do is you can just restrict to irrotational fluids. Okay, so you can decompose a four or a vector, okay, into different pieces, and you can suppose that it is fully described by the gradient of some scalar function phi, okay, up to some normalization here. Okay, and so this is called an irrotational fluid because from this definition you can define a notion of vorticity, and this vanishes in this case. Okay, and we also have here a concept, that curly letter that I actually don't know what it is. It's called the enthalpy. Okay. So under this restriction to irrotational fluids, your relativistic Euler equations take a much simpler form, okay, and they're reduced to a quasi-linear wave equation given here in equation 23. Okay, now this is quasi-linear because we have some coefficients, a mu nu. Okay, a mu nu is called the acoustic metric. But you see here in equation 24 that, well, it depends on your geometry G, but it also depends on U, and U depends on phi. Okay, so that's where you get the quasi-linear part there. Otherwise, it would just be linear. So this is still a very tough problem to study these PDEs, but obviously we've gone from a system of tensorial equations or a system of equations to just one PDE, okay, which makes things a lot easier to do. And so this is what has been done. Okay, so if you take, let's say, the Newtonian approximation of the relativistic Euler equations, you will get back actually the Euler equations, okay, in this situation for a perfect compressible fluid. Okay, and it's been known for a very long time that these equations admit shocks. Okay, so you can have smooth data which develops singularity in finite time. Now, I'm not going to be specific by what I mean by a shock in this talk, but let's just say, you know, a gradient blows up. Okay, so here is just a little picture of, I guess you could think of this as the Berger's equation, so evolution of some data, and eventually we develop a shock. Okay, so a gradient blows up there. And so this has been studied, well, since Riemann in 1800s, and let's say more recently by Sedaris, who very much showed shock formation for the compressible Euler equations. Okay, so now we can also study the relativistic Euler equations, okay, so the relativistic equations, as I said, on a fixed geometry to make things simpler. And this is, you can look at Minkowski, because that's the best place to start. And it was shown by Christodoulou that irrotational perturbations around the constant solution lead to finite time shock formation. Okay, so the constant solution here is just your energy density is constant, your fluid four velocity looks as such. The B here is supposed to denote the background, okay, your background solution. And you consider perturbations, so you consider some compact region where you know, slightly wobble that constant solution. Okay, and so this leads to finite time shock formation for a very large class of equations of state, okay, a very broad class of equations of state. So this is probably the most kind of expansive work looking at shock formation for the Euler equations on Minkowski. But I just want to mention that situations of global existence do actually occur. Okay, so you often hear lots of talks about shock formation, but let me just also emphasize that there are cases where you do get global regularity. Okay, so in particular, and this is also what Christodoulou identified, so if you consider this following expression, okay, of the equation of state and the energy density. And it happens that if this vanishes on the constant state, then no shocks form. Okay, and if you solve this, see what types of equations of state satisfy this, you get equation 25 here, which is called a Chaplin gas. And this is actually used, or was used at some point in astrophysics. Okay, so it's not an entirely unheard of equation of state. So now I want to move to cosmological models and see what happens. And one of the first works in this direction is by Brau, Rendell, and Royler from the 90s. And so they took a Newtonian cosmological model. Okay, so you replace Einstein's theory of general relativity with a more geometric version of Newtonian gravity. Okay, this is called Newton-Cotan theory. And I guess the L is there is also because we've got some cosmology involved. Okay, so they took this as their, let's say, governing PDEs, their governing equations, and they showed the following. So in the first case, they considered lambda to be positive, and they considered both a polytropic equation of state, so that's equation one there, or the case of dust, okay, equation two there. And they showed that small perturbations, well, they first of all constructed the homogeneous solutions, and then they showed that small perturbations of these solutions exist globally. Okay, so that was the first such result showing stability in that direction. And then in the final part of the paper, they also considered the case where the cosmological constant vanishes. Okay, in this case, because they've got fluid, the relevant geometry there, and this is in dust, so the relevant geometry there is Einstein de Sitter. So your scale factor is decelerating, it's this t to the 2/3. And they showed that trajectories of dust particles cross, okay, which means that the solution then becomes multivalued. Okay, so the solution breaks down. Okay, so what do we get from this? The key idea is that your space-time expansion can suppress shock formations in fluids. Okay, you're essentially pulling apart your fluid lines. Things are diluting faster as well. And so you're preventing, or it's less likely then for your fluid to develop shocks. And this is maybe another way then to think of Minkowski as a kind of very strange cosmological space-time where there is no expansion. Okay, so I think here of the scale factor as 1 squared. Okay, so nothing is expanding, so perhaps it's not so surprising that we get instances of shock formation there. Okay, and so this has led to a vast amount of literature. Okay, and so I'm just kind of summarizing them on this slide. So several people have looked at what we call uniformly quiet solutions to the Einstein-Lambda relativistic Euler equations. So I say lambda there because lambda is positive. You get here equation 26, roughly your solution. So you don't exactly get de Sitter. You'll get a perturbation off it, but your background scale factor will grow in an accelerated manner. It'll grow exponentially. Your energy density will, let's say, be given by a constant, rho naught, and it will scale. It will diminish, it will decrease with the scale factor at some appropriate rate, -3, 1+k. And we've got uniformly quiet solutions here, so the four velocity is just in the time-like direction. Okay, and so the theorem, broadly speaking, is that such solutions are stable. Okay, stable under the full nonlinear Einstein relativistic Euler equations. Okay, and so they're stable for the full parameter range of the equation of state, between 0 and 1/3, okay, definitely.
Why is it quotation
marks? Because I haven't stated it as a theorem. And I can't, you know, my supervisor would not approve. No, that's all, that's literally all. Sorry, because I'm trying to summarize lots of things, so I didn't want to offend. So let me also mention that in all these cases, in almost all of these, yes, I think in all of these cases, your spatial manifold, is taken to be T3. Okay, so it's taken to be R3 quotiented. And there also is work, for example, by Friedrich here, looking at more general, let's say, curved manifolds. Okay, but typically, these have just been studied on the torus. I said theorem in quotations because this is what a whole host of people have done in different parameter ranges. Okay, so the first work in this direction is that of Rudnyansky and Speck, and they showed... they prove like this theorem in the case of k strictly between 0 and 1/3 to irrotational perturbations. Okay, so they had to make a simplification. There's also been other work, in the radiation case, in the dust case. There's more recent works of Todd Olenek, which can now take us beyond 1/3 for the first time. where we actually thought there'd be instabilities arising. And I've also just put here, also Ringstrom, just because actually in this talk I didn't want to go into all the details, but all these works were predated by a 2008 work of Hans Ringstrom here, okay, which very much set the setting. The math methods that are used here come, a lot of these come from Hans Ringstrom. Okay, so as you can see here, fluids very much seem to be stable on geometries that expand at an exponential rate, okay, that undergo this accelerated expansion. And now there's also some literature looking at power law inflation. Okay, so what I do here is I focus on a fixed power law space-time, so equation 27 here, and so the scale factor goes like t to the p, and this space-time may not this metric may not satisfy the Einstein equations and hence be a space-time, but cosmologists do use this as some kind of little simple model, a toy model that they can study various things on. And so Speck in 2012 showed that the stability of homogeneous solutions to the relativistic Euler equations on these fixed geometries, okay, the background was given by equation 27, provided that certain integrability conditions held for the scale factor. Okay, so let me just give you an example. So if you're in the case of a radiation fluid, okay, where you do have pressure, then if 1 over the scale factor is integrable, your perturbation exists globally. Okay, but if it fails to be integrable, he could actually show that shocks form in finite time. Okay, so this tells you something about at what point do structures form in our universe at a certain scale. Okay.
So this is a non-linear result then?
No. This is a PDE result, but the background solution is homogeneous. Yeah. I just want to mention that this case of k equals 1/3 is a special case for the relativistic Euler equations because they're actually conformally invariant in this case. And so that's kind of partly how he was able to show the shock formation result, okay, because he just used the Christodoulou result as a black box. Okay, but I hope you can see that this the way the scale factor grows intimately affects the nature of the fluid. And so this is a little summary in a table of what is known. Okay, so if P is bigger than 1, then it's accelerated expansion, okay, and we know that we get stability by spec. When you go down to dust, there's no pressure, okay, there's less likely for shocks to form, okay, the fluid particles are not interacting in the same way, and so you can actually go down to deceleration, okay, P bigger than 1/2. When P is equal to 1, we have this blow-up result, okay, by spec, so in the case of K equals 1/3, we get shocks, and the first result that I want to tell you about of mine is kind of showing that this shock formation result of spec is sharp in the parameter K. Okay, so in particular, if P is equal to 1 and K is strictly between 0 and 1/3, we can show stability. Okay, now stability to irrotational perturbations, but we think that's just a technical restriction. We're working on something to remove that. And so this is what we showed. We showed that the canonical homogeneous solutions, okay, to the relativistic Euler equations on what we call Milne-like FLRW spacetimes. Okay, so I say Milne-like here because the scale factor grows like t to the 1. Okay, like a Milne, they are non-linearly stable. Okay, so this is the first non-dust fluid stabilization result outside of accelerated expansion, okay, below accelerated expansion. And I already mentioned the second point. Okay, so I'm actually not going to tell you about the proof here because it's kind of quite disjoint from the second proof. Okay, so I now want to move to the fluid gravity system, okay, so Einstein relativistic Euler. Okay, let me just emphasize that this result here was just for the relativistic Euler equations, okay, fixed geometry, but allowing the fluid to evolve. But I should just note that the relativistic Euler equation is the weakest link. Okay, it is almost, if you have a fluid that develops shocks, your geometry probably won't help. Okay, that's not as well understood, but yeah, the rule of thumb is that the relativistic Euler equation is the weakest link. Nevertheless, you know, Einstein Euler is still a complicated system. Okay, so the geometry that we're interested here is one that does not have a cosmological constant. Okay, so the cosmological constant is 0. We can't go all the way down to Einstein de Sitter just yet, so the thing to study is the Milne geometry, okay, which expands linearly. Okay, so it's just the kind of critical point going from accelerated down to decelerated. And so the model that we study is what's called the generalized Milne model. Okay, so we have now a compact three-manifold, okay, which admits a negative Einstein metric gamma. Okay, so a negative Einstein metric just means that the Ricci of gamma is equal to minus a constant times gamma. Okay, and that constant you can essentially relabel up to scaling. Okay, so this is the generalized Milne model, and you'll notice again that the scale factor A of T grows like TC. Okay, so it grows linearly. So this is an example of zero accelerated expansion. It is known to be stable as a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations, and this was shown by Anderson and Moncrief in work in, okay, earlier work also 2003, but the kind of the full work in 2011. Okay, so they showed vacuum stability where n is bigger than or equal to 3. I should just mention that in a lot of these nonlinear stability results, they're very, very long. Yeah, you know, the stability of Minkowski, the first proof by Christa Dudley-Kleinemann is 500 pages. The later proof by Lindblad and Minyansky, it's about 60, okay, which is still pretty long. Trust me, I read it a lot in my thesis. Somehow Milne is actually, if you're interested in nonlinear stability results, Milne is a very nice stepping stone, okay, because somehow you've got a bit of expansion in there. Okay, so you can things are a bit simpler. Okay, the proof goes a lot faster. Okay, but you can still get to see some of the PDE techniques that you need to show stability. Obviously, probably the best one to study is De Sitter by Friedrich, but okay, there's also that too. Okay, so this is the Milne vacuum stability. And just a small point here, when you might say, why do we have n bigger than or equal to 3? So when n equals 3, you can show that gamma will have constant negative sectional curvature and hence will be a hyperbolic metric, and you have something called Mostov rigidity here. And so somehow in n equals 3, you have some kind of rigidity that prevents your spatial metric from evolving. Okay, so maybe the best way to think about it is what I said already, is that when you perturb a black hole, you will get a different black hole, okay, different black hole parameters, and one of the difficulties in the problem is determining those parameters. Somehow in Milne, that's also possible. You could imagine perturbing this geometry. You could imagine evolving to a different negative Einstein metric, okay, possibly with the same constant. Okay, and somehow in n equals 3, you don't have that problem. Okay, so it just makes the analysis a lot simpler. But nevertheless, when n is bigger than 3, there's some really nice analysis of the moduli space that Anderson and Moncrief did. So it's still a very interesting question. Okay, and so what we did is that we started with the case that was most likely to be stable, okay, that of dust. And so this is what we showed in a preprint, is we showed that Milne is a stable solution to the Einstein dust equations. Okay, crucially here, lambda is equal to 0. And so this is the first example of a fluid gravity stabilization where your space-time expansion is non-accelerated. Now, it turns out, the Milne has been studied in lots of different scenarios, not just as a solution to the Einstein dust equations, but as a solution to other kinds of matter equations. So that's why I'm saying here with matter stability. So there's a work on Einstein-Vlasov by Anderson Feynman. There's a work on Einstein-Maxwell scalar field by Brandin, Feynman, Kronka. And there's one work here from my PhD. And also Wang, we showed two separate ways, stability, the Einstein-Klein-Gordon equation. And then there's more recent work by Hamed, Bazagar, and Feynman. Okay, looking at Vlasov, Maxwell. Okay, so Milne has been studied in various settings. Okay, and I guess it's a good situation to study these kinds of stabilization results. But it turns out actually the most relevant result for us is the dust work of Hadzik and Speck. Okay, so that's in the case of accelerated expansion, and there were certain ideas from this paper that we were able to use. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit for the rest of the talk, a little bit about the proof. And I'm strongly of the belief that you should kind of ignore as many details as you can where possible. So you can zone out for the next two slides if you want. So firstly, we have the unknown metric, which here I've called G bar. Okay, and we're looking at its evolution. Okay, G bar is going to be a perturbation of the background solution. And instead of studying the components of G bar, I'm going to study the ADM variables, okay, represented in a different way. So here I have the lapse, the lapse n, the shift x, the Riemannian metric G, and also a second fundamental form K, which I haven't written down here. Okay, so we use an ADM ADM splitting, and I also need to fix the gauge invariance of the Einstein equations. Okay, for this problem to actually make sense, we need to fix the coordinates, and so we use coordinates introduced in this cosmological setting by Anderson and Moncrief. and they're called CMCSH. Okay, so CMC is constant mean curvature, and SH is spatially harmonic. So where does this, why do you choose these coordinates? So if you look at the mean curvature, which I denote here by tau, with respect to the cosmic time representation of Milne that I had on the previous slide, you see that the mean curvature is equal to minus 3 over cosmic time. Okay, so you realize that instead of labeling your time slices by cosmic time, you could instead label them by tau, okay, the mean curvature. And because this holds true on the background, you then can show that for a small perturbation, the manifold will also admit a CMC foliation. Okay, so this is why we choose foliation whose slices have constant mean curvature, t equals tau. And then we use the spatially harmonic gauge because the Einstein equations, you know, give you very nice properties with respect to this gauge. Okay, so for example, Minkowski is known to be stable under the full space-time harmonic gauge. Okay, that's the proof of Lindblad and Rynjanski. Okay, so this is a gauge that has been well studied. Okay, but here we take the spatial version of it. Okay, now also in cosmology, because we have these expanding variables, it is good practice, but not widely followed, to account for this spatial expansion. Okay, so you rescale your variables to take out this expansion so you can actually see what is going on, okay, when you take out that expansion. So there's a whole equation 31 here is just encapsulating the idea that you rescale everything. Okay? And you also use a rescaled time, okay, because now we're labeling time with mean curvature, but that has the wrong sign, doesn't quite, goes to zero, and you really, we like to think of time going to infinity, so you also rescale time and you get this capital T here. Okay. And so what are our unknowns? Okay, so we have a lapse, we have a shift, a Riemannian metric G, and it turns out that it is better to study the trace-free part of the second fundamental form, which I denote by sigma. Okay, so that's given in equation 32. So with respect to this whole setup, the background Milne solution is given here by equation 33. Okay, so I hope you can see that it's a very simple form, okay, which makes it obviously easy then what, you know, it's useful to have it in this form. Okay, so this is all the setup, so now zone back in. Okay, so I haven't written down the system of PDEs, okay, with respect to this gauge, and this is obviously the thing that determines all the dynamics. So it turns out that this gauge actually gives elliptic equations for the lapse and the shift variables. Okay, so equation 34 here. So the first equation is the elliptic equation for the lapse, and I've put minus 1 plus dot, 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 because the minus 1 really should be the dominating piece here, and kind of the other term should be higher order, okay, if you put in the expected asymptotics. Same here for the Ricci, for the shift. Okay, we get here an elliptic equation, and we get a Ricci term appearing. Okay, so 0 there should be the dominant part on the right-hand side, plus some higher-order terms. So these are the elliptic equations, and then we also get hyperbolic equations. Okay, first-order hyperbolic equations, as they're written here, but you can take another time derivative and see that they are really wave equations, okay, for the metric and the trace-free part of the second fundamental form. And there's a whole host of very important numbers on the right-hand side here, okay? So, you know, the fact that there's a 2 and a minus 3, things like that, that's very important. It depends on the dimension, but it's very important to the analysis that comes later on. I just want to mention that, so a few more things to mention here. So we also get this operator L here, calligraphic L, appearing. Okay, so it acts, it's defined by this. Okay, so given in equation 36 here, so it needs to act on two tensors because I've got a Riemann curvature term there, so that needs to contract on something. It can't act on scalars. Okay, so this is this differential operator. It is actually a self-adjoint elliptic operator on the manifold, on the three space. It's closely related to something called the Lichnerowitz-Laplacian. Okay, so in Riemannian geometry, if you look at second variations of the Einstein-Hilbert action at a Ricci flat metric, you will get this operator appearing. Okay, so it's been very well studied in the Riemannian literature, things like its spectrum, okay, it's self-adjoint, it emits a discrete spectrum. But a good way to think of it is what I've put in blue here, okay, is just think of it as two derivatives, okay, Nabla squared. Whichever Nabla it is, let's not worry, okay, but just think of it as two derivatives, okay. You'll note then that kind of when you study these PDEs, you need to be quite careful at the order of regularity, okay, because here on the left, let's say with the lapse, you've got two spatial derivatives, okay? Here for the hyperbolic, you've got one time derivative on the left, but here, you know, you've got L, so you've got two derivatives there on the metric, and here you've got two derivatives on the lapse, Okay, so there's some kind of counting that needs to be done in this process. But your aim in all of this is to prove that solutions exist, okay, global solutions exist, okay, under some smallness assumption on the initial data, and you want to show that they exist as T goes to infinity, okay, because that maps to the cosmological future, right, yeah, that capital T. Okay, so from a PDE point of view, what do? You study certain Sobolev norms, okay, and try and control them, okay, for a long time. So you try and show that a certain set of norms of these variables, let's say, goes to zero with a certain rate that implies future completeness. Doesn't really matter so much for the talk at what rate. And this notation here, HS, or this notation S here, is what I mean by a Sobolev norm. And you'll note here that we have these different orders. Okay, so we've got S plus 1 here, S plus 1, S, S minus 1. Okay, so that's all from looking at the PDEs, okay, and seeing what you can get. Okay, so how do you control a Sobolev norm? How do you do that? You typically write out the Sobolev norm. You take the time derivative of it. You substitute in your equation of motion. And then you do lots of integration by parts and Cauchy-Schwarz. Okay. Now, in this setting, it's not quite as simple. And this is what Anderson and Moncrief developed. Okay, is they developed the use of a coercive energy with correction terms. Okay, so just very naively here, you'd like to control here in equation 37. You'd like to control these norms, okay, so this is sigma in L2, by some functional E1, okay, which just depends on time. And you want E1 to roughly look like an energy. Okay, so very roughly speaking, E1 looks like this term in equation 38. Okay, so we've got things and energies have things squared, so sigma squared and G minus gamma, L G minus gamma. Okay, so sigma is like the second fundamental form. The second fundamental form is like the time derivative of the metric. So you can think of this first term here as being the kinetic part of an energy. And the second part here, well, L is like Nabla squared. I can integrate by parts. I can put one of those Nablas on the other term. Let's not worry about minus signs. And so I roughly get the potential part in the energy. I get Nabla of G. Obviously, Nabla here would be from the background geometry, so it wouldn't just vanish. Okay, so that's why we call these energies, is because at a very heuristic level, they are what you would expect from an energy, okay? There's a kinetic and there's potential part. And you want to choose this energy in a way that it obeys a good estimate. Okay, so for example, something written in equation 39 here, dt of E1 minus 2, something like that. So if you can control... Oh, sorry, and it should be E1 on the right-hand side there, my bad. Okay, but the idea being that if you can control E1, then you can come up here and you can control the Sobolev norms that you're trying to control. Okay, so this is one of the strategies. It turns out you need to be quite subtle, take care of the numbers, have a corrected energy. And so this here is given in equation 40. This is what Anderson and Moncrief realized. So you get a correction term, which is coming from this CE term. And this actually depends on the smallest positive eigenvalue of this operator L evaluated at the background. Okay, and you need to add this term back in order to get back the energy. So what do I mean by that? So if you take this term in blue, okay, so E2 here, and then I've got this term in blue, so I take dt of E2, put in that time derivative, I'm going to end up with this term down here, dt of E, of sigma. Okay. I then substitute in the equation of motion. Well, that, with the signs, ends up being minus 2 of sigma. Okay. And so I almost get back E2. Yeah. If you take this minus 2 times the half, you get minus... Then you've got sigma L sigma. That's exactly what's appearing up here. But you also need the other term. Okay, and in order to get that other term, that's why you have to add this correction term in. Okay, because you want to get back the energy. You want to get back the full E2 here. Okay, you can't just have part of it. All right, so that's one of the ideas there. Okay, so now let's include matter. Let's see what happens. So the matter now just appears all in your PDEs. So, for example, the lapse equation now picks up a contribution term here, eta, okay, some matter component, all right, and you need to see what happens. And if you look at the equations for the geometry here, rather, you've got dt of sigma on the left, and you've got rho and u on the right. Okay, so this suggests, very naively, that we need rho and u to be at the same level of regularity, same Sobolev space as sigma. Okay, but then you look at the equations for the fluid, and you get something different. Okay, so we have here an equation for the fluid four velocity, or its spatial components. Okay, and so this would suggest that we need U and sigma to be at the same order, because sigma does not appear differentiated on the right-hand side. But the other equation suggests that we want rho and sigma at the same order, but we want U, because of this term in red, at one order higher. Okay, so that one of the issues with the dust equations of motion is regularity, and this is exactly what happens. So to resolve this, we follow an idea of Hadzikin spec, okay, which is to use a fluid derivative, or sometimes called a material derivative, given here in equation 43. Okay, so this is some operator, differential operator, partial U, which is, you know, some time derivative, some fluid contraction. So roughly think, you can roughly think of it as U alpha, nabla alpha, okay, some contraction of that type. And so we use it as a differential operator in the energy functionals. Okay, so this means now that our matter PDEs look as follows in equation 44. So I just pick up this operator here on the left with the terms as before. And I now commute the Einstein equations not with n copies of a spatial derivative, but n minus 1 copies and a fluid derivative. Okay, obviously the fluid derivative has a time piece in it, okay, so you need to worry a bit, but that's kind of how you're going to overcome this. And what I've written here, the technical paths really don't matter, but just, you know, we need to adapt our bootstrap conditions. You've got different things in here, you've got different assumptions, all that kind of doodah. Okay, so this is what we do. So we adapt our geometric energy functional. So for example, this is what we had before, and we now put a du everywhere. Okay. And then if we take the time derivative, we can now replace terms using this fluid derivative. So for example, if we go back to think of that du sigma term that we spoke about earlier, well, if we take a time derivative, we'll end up with, let's say, dul times dt of sigma. And I replace dt of sigma now with a rho, and then I come down here. And so then I've got a tau times a rho, and now I commute in the differential operator du. Okay, and so now instead I replace du rho here with the right-hand side of its equation of motion. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is this really following flow lines or more or less?
I think more or less. I don't think, yeah. Yeah, no, I think it is. I guess it is, yeah. Yeah. I think probably how I I think here I've put the background gamma, the background covariant derivative. So I think right, that's the difference. But I think in principle I could have done the full metric, yeah. In which case, it would be that. Okay, so it's a differential operator that is more adapted to the fluid, and that's the idea to have. And so, you know, in this case, for example, we don't have to estimate too many derivatives of rho. Okay, since it's, for example, here the gradient of rho is already contained in the differential operator. Okay, du rho. So it somehow saves you there. Okay, so this is my last slide. It's a little bit technical. I apologize, but I think it's the most interesting part of the paper. It's all about regularity, which I'm not very happy with because that's not how I think, but you have to be extra careful at certain terms, okay? Somehow you need extra ideas for certain top-order lapse and shift estimates. So what I've written here at the top is at some point you have to estimate something of this type, okay? DULK, Lie derivative of G with respect to X. Now, very heuristically, this is like DU, okay, and then nabla 2k plus 1, because remember this operator L has two spatial derivatives in it. Okay, so this is 2k plus 1. And somehow this is too many derivatives on the shift. Okay, so instead, what do? We need to avoid this somehow. Okay, so we write out one of these L operators. Okay, to leading order, that's just the Laplacian. Okay, to leading order, you can write this as a Laplacian plus some lower order terms that you can estimate. So that's how now I get an LK minus 1 here times delta, okay, the Laplacian, with respect to G, okay, on the Lie derivative. And then I commute some derivatives, okay, I commute the Lie derivative with the elliptic operator. Okay, so now I have elliptic equations, this delta X here, I have elliptic equations for the shift. So I substitute in the equations of motion. Now, that elliptic equation for the shift, I'm not sure you remember, it was like delta x plus Ricci x is equal to stuff. Okay, so I now pick up that Ricci x term, and that's what comes here, plus probably some contractions or some covariant derivatives that give us Riemann tensors. Okay. So then it turns out that these terms combine using the Bianchi identity. Okay, and that's where I think the magic happens. Somehow the Bianchi identity comes in and saves you here, and it ends up giving you certain expressions, okay, just involving the Ricci. And then we use the fact that we're in a spatially harmonic gauge. And the Ricci tensor in such a gauge takes a very special form. Okay, so that's the next piece that we do, which turns this Ricci, okay, XK, nabla K, Ricci, it turns it into this operator L acting on the metric perturbation, G minus gamma. Okay, so that's coming from the gauge. So now this term is getting better. Okay, we don't have too many derivatives on the shift now. Okay, so you look here at this dul k minus 1. Okay, and so you think if all those derivatives hit the shift, that's what I've tried to write here on this bottom right term. Okay, and somehow that's okay. You can estimate that. But now we've got too many derivatives possibly hitting the metric. Okay, so now we've got another problem. All right, because here we've got xk. We could have nabla k, we could have all the du, all the lks, all hitting that metric term. Okay, so we've kind of taken one problem and put it somewhere else. And actually, at this point, it turns out that the structure of the energy saves us. Okay, because it takes a symmetric form. Okay, so this problematic piece, this bottom piece here, ends up taking a symmetric form here. Okay, and so you can actually just integrate by parts. Okay, and put the derivatives on the shift, and that closes your estimates. Okay, so obviously, there's a lot of technical things here, but I hope you at least can appreciate that there's some nice combination here of ideas from your equations of motion, your Bianchi, your gauge. They all need to combine together in the right way to show, to kind of close your arguments. Okay, so in summary, this is what I've told you today. Homogeneous solutions to the relativistic Euler equations on these Milne-like spacetimes are stable to irrotational perturbations in this particular range of the dust parameter. I've told you that Milne is a stable solution to the Einstein dust equations. Okay, so that's when k is equal to zero. And there's a lot of future work. Okay, so we have this case here, the k, when the parameter k goes between a third and one, that's actually very much open. Okay, that's not as well understood. Something I am quite interested in is that we have this blow-up result of spec, okay, in the case of radiation, and that's on a torus, that's on T3. And I'd like to understand if I replace that with a hyperbolic manifold, okay, something that's negatively curved, does that blow-up still hold? Okay, because you think of negative curvature, it's going to defocus your fluid lines. Is it possible that that's sufficient to prevent shock formation? I think it's a very subtle question. I think it's probably not true, but I'm still optimistic at this point. Can we study decelerating cases? Okay, there actually hasn't been much done here at the nonlinear level. And obviously looking at Milne fluid stability when k is not just zero, but can between zero and a third. Okay, so with that, I'll end my talk. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Zoe. I mean, it's really, in my young years when, years ago, I used to, in the pioneering years when we didn't even know about how to handle evolution problems, I got my hands wet with this a little bit. And, but it was years ago. I shifted more to the elliptic side now, and so. But I mean, it's so impressive how clever are the things that people invent and new and always new tricks to handle these terrible Einstein equations. So, and so thanks for this. Congratulations for this nice result. Thank you for this very nice introduction to the topic and presenting us our talk. So if we have questions, probably for the sake of the online participants, there should be a microphone for... So if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand and we're going to use the microphone. Yeah? No questions from the audience. So how do we control questions from the... web, how does this work? No questions?
That's okay. I'll be around for a couple of days. You can always ask questions then.
Yes. Yes, sir. So there's a question over there, please.
Okay, can you hear me?
Perfect. Yeah.
Okay. I have a very naive question. First of all, if you don't have any acceleration, and a homogeneous solution, is it stable or not?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what we're showing is also that we're also showing the zero solution is the stable one, right? So the energy density is going to zero.
Okay, so in principle, of course not, rigorously not, but heuristically, in principle, you expect that if this is a stable for the, I mean, without acceleration, if you have acceleration, you expect that shock formation is even more difficult to form, right? Heuristically.
Yeah. But I guess people have, if I understand correctly, people have obviously gone the other way because it's easier to study it first with accelerated expansion.
Okay. Thank you for the answer.
Thanks.
Yeah. Other questions?
Thank you for the talk. I have just a question. You are doing the whole analysis on torus. Do you need compact, like the hypersurface, or is it possible to do it also like with different topology?
Yeah, really good question. So I guess here it's the torus, mainly because you have to worry about asymptotic decay if you have R3, and it gets a bit messy. If you can show it on the torus, it almost certainly will then... If you can show it on a compact space, it almost certainly will then hold on the non-compact space. But maybe it's a bit harder with your estimates. But yeah, indeed, looking at things like this and trying to change the geometry, I guess that's something that students of David are doing, and yeah, is of interest.
Thank you.
Do you know whether there's been any progress on the just vacuum Milne, but in the contracting direction? Have you thought about it? Have you looked at that?
No, but I think someone told me to think about it. I feel like Eric Ling has studied that a bit more. I think his kind of questions are a bit different.
Was it not homogeneous setting?
I don't remember, yeah. I don't... I think actually there's Liam. I think there's a student of David who is now starting to look at linear waves going in that direction. So I guess maybe not as much is known. But yeah, sorry, I don't know that as well.
I have also a question both for you and for the audience, or maybe from the Zoom audience. So when teaching the introduction to cosmology, I've never found a simple explanation why K equal 1/3 is actually radiation fluid. So it's simple in the sense that you can just present it to in an elementary fashion in a lecture to students who are just starting. So if someone knows a good reference or if you happen to know one, I'd be...
So in the textbook by Shoke Bruha, she has a nice little paragraph, but I think it assumes a lot of knowledge already.
Look at that.
But yeah, and indeed, when I learned it in cosmology, it definitely took a long time.
Standard explanation is, you want a traceless energy momentum tensor, and that 1/3 does it for you, and you're happy with this. But of course, it's just ridiculous as an explanation.
No, somehow I've seen it more from like thermodynamics arguments. Somehow there was.
So if you know some elementary ones or anyone knows, please send me an email with a reference. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
So, coming to you.